Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are The Washboard Resonators. Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome back to this week's episode of the Washboard Resonators Present, and we're going to get into the second half of the interview with legendary drummer Pete James. This time we're going to hear what happened to him after he finished with the Blackjacks. We're kind of going into the 70s and we'll hear how he got into backing some of the biggest stars of the day like Freddie Starr, Bob Monkhouse, Alf Garnett, Maxwell, Ricky Valens, people like that. And we're also going to hear about his extensive Ludwig collection. We ended up having, I think, about 60 odd drum kits at one stage. So we'll hear how he started collecting them and why, and some of the special pieces he's got. So look forward to this one. Here we go.
The band got fired.
Right.
Al Harris was the name of the entertainment boss of Butlin's Minehead all the years that we played there.
Right.
He was strict but fair. He called me in the office and he said, I'm sorry about that. He said, but I know I got a lot of respect for you and the Blackjacks original band. You've been so good to us over the years and blah, blah, blah. I don't want to see you going home. He said, you've got a wife and children. He said, would you like to stay on freelance? Yeah. Now, I felt awful for the boys going home, but I didn't really know them. I'd only met them a fortnight before. Mm-hmm. And they had all the chances in the world. And, we were on different levels, like different, we were in different thinking, like, you know. They were good boys, actually, you know. But I don't think they had enough experience of being out there in the world that I was brought up in. I'm not saying what I was doing was right, but yeah, it certainly was required. And I stayed on, and I tell you what, things started happening for me in a different way then, because I thought I was a bit worried about leaving the stability of the Blackjacks and getting a day job and doing, you know, get out of the business. And no, it happened the other way around. I started doing things like study by the swimming pool, just a snare drum, the piano, booty contest.
Were they kind of making gigs for you, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. I was doing that, and then I did a couple of the pit jobs with the dance, the orchestra. I enjoyed that, dancing girls and comedians and playing for everybody. I'd never done that before.
You'd learned to read by now then?
Yes. And because all the years I was at Minehead, I'd met a guy called Jack, who was a drummer in the pit. He was there for about two of the years. And he was a really old geezer, like, and he timps, glockenspiel, kit. He had it all, like, you know. And he'd been on the liners, which is, you had to be good to be on them in those days, you know. He's a proper old pro musician. And he used to come and watch me playing up in the rock and roll ballroom. And I didn't know who he was. So he used to sit in the back and watch to go. And I used to go then over to the pit, to the shows, to get a seat on the front and amongst all the makers, you know. I was looking over to the pit and watching. How does he know to do that there? Like, I was thinking. And then I went to talk to him after the show went out. I went over the thing. I said, hi. He said, I said, I'm the drummer up in the rock and roll ballroom. I said, I'm watching you play. And so I said, you the guy up there? Yeah. Wow. He said, you got a good pair of hands on you. You went like that. And he carried on packing stuff away. You see? I thinking, I've got to get this guy's knowledge. And he started giving me tips on what to do and, you know, look at the scores. And he showed me the show, what he'd just done. And I could read, right? But I couldn't see. I said, yeah, but how did you do that there? I saw you going, ladies and gentlemen, blah, blah, blah. And then you went, did something. I said, and the band came in. Where's that there? Oh, no, it's not there. I said, it's a throwaway bar, I said. And I learned these little tricks, you know. And see them with you. He said, yeah. So I fade there, yeah. And he's talking, and that could be different every night. Because you're up to, it's all on the guy on the stage talking. He adds a few words in or drops a few words. But the next thing is, and dancing girls come out, and then the big line, the big row of chorus girls, like, see? And when you hear that and see it, you're thinking, how the hell do you get into that? Like, you know, it's another musical thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
He was really, really helpful to me, you know? Then in the end, I was sitting in the thing. Then I was doing the standing gigs and stuff in the pit orchestra. And I learned a lot. And up in the dance hall then, the modern dance hall, they call it, was like something like a 15, 20-piece band playing quick steps, waltzes, all that. If you remember now, that's where I started as a 11, 12-year-old kid. But it's a real band playing it here now. And their drummer, I can't remember if he's American or Canadian, used to walk in, play, walk out. Walk in, play, get out. And the other guys in the band wanted to play jazz and stuff, see? So they were up in a pub. It's called the Hobby Horse on the seafront of Minehead there. And this guy asked me, he said, do you play jazz? I said, do you know, I've never played jazz. I love jazz, I said, but I never, well, here's your chance. He said, bring your kit up on Sunday morning. He said, and play with us. These guys out of my league. Oh, they're awesome players. Awesome players. Oh, my God. I had a lesson. You tell me about people like Ed Thigpen, you know, Art Blakey, people I didn't know about, really, you know. And you bring the records in and giving them to me. I still got them. I still got them. They gave them to me. Listen to these guys, he said. And I was. I could use it. So when I stick these oaks in, they go, oh, yeah. He's been playing the records and all that. And all. He might have been rubbish coming out of me. I don't know. Out of time, I don't know. But I was going for it, like, you know. And again, another learning curve, wasn't it? To me, you know. And come back into 67 where there's on my own now. It's just coming to his own now because I was getting a bit more confident because I was on my own. I had to do it or finish.
Yeah, yeah.
And, then Chris turned up. Chris Lazenby. And then he put us in the Pig and Whistle, they call it, pub. Well, we rocked the place. We rocked it. This duo just rocked it. It was jam-packed and we were slamming him out. And it's kind of a little bit like the Blackjacks, a bit more raunchy. And White Sheet of Pale just come out. Remember that came out, where we had to play at 6-10 times a night or they wouldn't let us out of the room.
Were you singing now as well?
Yeah. I'm going to go like. And I got through that season. I party company with Chris then. And funny thing is, I gave him my pass. We had a pass with photos, like an ID on it. I gave him mine and I got his year. And I haven't met him since. I'd like to see him, what he's doing. Mm-hmm. But his name has come up to me. When I was then, I went into cabaret playing in nightclubs and stuff like that, and people's music was coming in, arranged by Chris Lazenby.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I'm not surprised, because what we done on the camp in Minehead, in lockdown in the theatre, say 9 o'clock in the morning till about, say, 3 in the afternoon, he'd be in there, concert pianist, playing beautiful. Then with us in the night, rock and roll, anything, not rocker, anything, and singing anything. He was a great musician, very good natural, something about him again, you know. And I came home from Man 67 that season, and I was a bit worried then, what am I going to do? Again, rehearsed the band in Carmarthen, in view of going back to Hamburg.
Right.
And we're going to drop anything to do with the Blackjacks now. I want it away from me. One suit, modern day looking suit, and get out to Hamburg with this new band. We won't be called the Blackjacks, we call ourselves the Jacks. But a photo session taken. And then what happened was then the bass player gave up his job. He was a tax inspector. He gave up his job. The vocalist, Peter, he gave up his job. He worked in the parts department of a motor company. And poor old Graham, man, he said he gave up his job, the lead guitarist. And the last, down to the wire, he didn't come. So it didn't materialize. So I thought, it hit me like a rock. I thought, the Blackjacks instilled so much professionalism in me and do things right. I couldn't accept somebody not turning up late. And that's how I was dealing with these boys.
I think maybe it was a bit naive of like, if you're working with
any
small town bands, so the people, they're not going to have the mentality of people who have travelled and lived in those cities and done those sort of things.
Yeah. They're great musicians, you know. Don't get me wrong. There's drummers around you, blow you away, like, you know, and there's guitarists, they're gifted. But you can't give them a gig because for different reasons, you know. They turn up slobby or they'd be drunk or it's a night out to them.
Mm.
It's not them being paid to do a job for the people out the other side. And that's what the Blackjacks are.
Did it change your attitude towards the blackjack when you started running bands and you realised a lot of the pitfalls of dealing with people? Did you sort of see things differently then?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I realised what the blackjacks were. I can remember what an ass I was with some of the things that you're trying to get me to do. I said, okay, New Year's me now, trying to get these people to do it. Simple things like, you know, that should be done.
Like turning up.
Turning up. Exactly.
So did you ever get a chance to speak to the people from the Blackjacks and say, like, oh, I now realise actually how well run this was and I respect, you know, even more what you guys were doing? Did you ever get that opportunity?
The only one I've ever seen mainly, Pat was a girl singer, but she left in 64 anyway. And okay. The band went on until 66. She lives about 12 miles up the road from me now. The bass player, he's just passed away about 6-7 months ago.
Oh dear.
Yeah, he was one of the English lads who came originally in 1958 to Wales. I was in contact with him till the end. He played with various bands around here, but he did a day job. Robbie Williams, the singer, lead and rhythm player, I haven't seen him since 1965. I don't know whatever happened to him. But the lead guitarist, Don, he always watched my career from after the Blackjacks. And he always sang my praises to everybody.
Oh, that's nice. If you didn't need to do that, if you didn't split on amicable terms necessarily.
No, well, I was trying to get away from him and his wife, and he knew it. But he always, I've done gigs with people afterwards who knew him. He said, oh, you were in a band with Don Callard, didn't you? He said, yeah. Oh, he's always talking about you. He said, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which was nice. Hence, I think that's why they had faith in me when I was 15 doing the audition. He could see something I could be moulded into their taken along with them, perhaps.
Yeah.
You know, because other guys probably could play better, but, oh, well, we'll do it like this, like telling them what to do, like, I wear jeans, I do, see? Sort of attitude, like, you know. Coming back to 67, end of season then, when I came home, I rehearsed this band in Carmarthen, fell flat. And then I saw an advert in Melody Maker, a box ad, professional drummer wanted, reader, all styles, must be able to play modern dance, blah, 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 box number. Now, I just, you know, Strictly Come Dancing thing you see now, I just done one of them at the end of 67 season down in Minehead with a big band. So it just drummed into me now, waltzes, quick steps. Things are done when I was 12, but more professional with this band, obviously. Bloke would set it with a metronome in his hand. I answered his ad, and I said to Gwyneth, I got to do something. I said, you know, but it could be Newcastle, it could be Scotland, it could be Ireland, anyway. I said, could be any. It was Swansea.
Oh, it didn't ever said on the advert where it was?
No, it's a box number. I rang the box number, and bloke said something, and he said to me on the phone, oh, I know who you are, he said. Oh, and I said, who am I speaking to? Never mind about that, he said. I thought, all right. Oh, yeah, this was the audition. And I said, okay. I said, so where am I speaking to? Swansea, he said. I said, oh, it's the gig in Swansea. It is. As it was, very office, like, you know. I said, all right, so how many nights a week is it? Six. Right. And it's all cut the air with a knife, like, you know. And he said, so you come along Tuesday, 2 o'clock, prompt. Okay, thank you. I go along, right, and he never guessed what happened to me. I took Gwyneth and my son with me in the car. And she lives halfway to Swansea. I was going to drop him off now. Stone I got through the window. Smashed the windscreen, cut my son as well, right? So that took about at least half of a quarter of my time sorting it out, right? I got there, and he walked in off the street. In these nightclubs, you walk in, and it's pitch black in the daytime. There's a guy standing there. He said, oh, can I help you? I said, I got an audition. I'm supposed to meet somebody. Oh, and he's supposed to say, hey, Ron, is somebody here for you? It's all black and dark now, right? And his voice came back and said, he's late. I thought, I recognised that voice from the phone, right? Very abrupt. I got upstairs, it was Terry Williams' father.
Wow.
First place, Ron, see? And I looked at him, I thought, I know you from somewhere. He booked original Black Jacks in, what, 1960, 61, at that place when it was a dance hall.
Wow.
See? So that's how he knew I was. And this is what he said to me. Right, I know all about you, he said. I know you play the drums. And before you start, I warn you, I've had every drummer around you been in here. So I'm not going to mess about with the pops and the rock and roll. You just can do strict modern dancing, because I haven't found anybody to do it. And I'll be the judge. Now, I didn't tell him, I've just done 6 weeks of this at the top level with one of the best bands in the country for Strictly Come Dancing. Right? And I didn't tell him, because even that kind of bloke you could talk to.
Yeah.
You know? So he said, right, we start off with the fox trot. He goes, 1, 2, 3, 4. And he's lifting up, so I lift up a bit, like, there's no music.
Sorry, was he playing piano or something?
An organ and feet on bass pedals. Right, he went, okay. He went, okay. Right, he goes, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't bad, but he wasn't good, you know. I'm going to say something nasty. He went, you know. And he goes, right, yeah. Right, let's try an old-time waltz then. And he started playing, didn't count me in. So I just went, and he looked at me. He never complimented me. Never said, in fact, he said, maybe the quick step was a little bit rushed. A bit rushed on the quick step. Right, I said, okay. I know what I was thinking. It wasn't a good quick step. I just played a load of quick step. And the people that I was playing for, right, were professional dancers. You know that Len Goodwin is on the telly?
Yeah.
He was one of them. A young Len Goodwin.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
He was one of them. I'd like to meet him and remind him about it. Minot, 1967. And anyway, he gave me the job. 6 nights a week. So I was back in business. Oh, brilliant. I turned up the first night. I didn't know what I was going into.
Was this just doing the job, Pete? Was 6 nights a week of just the dance band?
No, it was we played all pop music. He had a great, he's even playing, right? The lead singer was a guy called Bobby Wayne, and there's at least three girls, and one of the girls is Bonnie Tyler now. She's one of them. And anyway, he was banging all the pops out. I did all the visiting artists, and I wasn't playing for them. It was an in-house band playing for them, see?
Yeah.
And I used to watch all that, thinking, that's what I'd like to do, I'd like to do that now. Plus, I like the band I'm with. But all visit artists were complimentary to the band that I was in with Ron. Right? I was the only organ and drums back in. It was a hell of a full sound.
Oh, it's just the two of you. Oh, I thought.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
The vocals.
But
you want to hear the sound and the vocals. I mean, you name any song, Beach Boys, it'd be a 5-6 piece harmonies. And of course, Bonnie Tyler, as you know, her voice. So in the mix, we were covering such a lot of stuff. A lot of artists felt threatening. The visiting artists were getting paid to come as cabaret. We were on for an hour. Then they had to go on after us. They felt a bit thin because people waited for us to come back on. Not because of me, because the whole package, you know?
Yeah.
It was a finished thing. But he never said nothing about the dance thing, right? So then I'd been here about 6 months, and I saw Terry, the son now, right? And Terry had made it now. But he was starting to knock about with Rock Pile and bands like that, right?
How old is Terry at this point?
He's about five years behind me. So anyway, Terry comes in, he said, oh, the old man was chuffed, you know, because he'd had all the bashers in, all the Swansea bashers, you know, and to have somebody like you, versatile, like, you know. He said, you're very versatile, you listen. So anyway, I had egg on my face. 6 months later, he started doing a professional dance thing on a Sunday, which was an extra night's work for me, you know, right? More money. But he said, you've got to be good here. He said, why, Ed? We're having all the professional dance. He said, the first one I got come in are the British and European Latin American champions.
Wow.
So, first Sunday night I get there, all these local Swansea people coming in now, all the old biddies, I mean, a lot of youngsters as well, into this modern ball and that's it. Putting chalk on the floor, rubbing it in, gliding around, testing. I thought, oh my God, here we go. This is, you know, took me back to my dead, like, you know. And they come in, or the professionals come in, didn't see me at first, see? Didn't see me. And then they were dancing along on the girl, and she looked like that. She went, "Look who's on the drums." She went like that. "It's Pete," she said. And I said, "Oh, hello." And they face like thunder. "How do you know them?" I said, "Oh," I said, "I met them down in Minehead." "What do you mean?" I said, "Oh, I did a Strictly Come Dancing." "You didn't tell me that." I said, "Well, you said the application was to play all this music." I said, "I can play it." A few weeks later, somebody else walks in. Another one. You know what I mean? That's not my fault, is it? I mean, yeah. I was with these people for weeks, you see, down in my head.
Yeah, you never asked.
Never asked. And I don't say, like, you know, I just thought it was something I'd done. I move on, I won't ever see him again, like, innit? But with Ron there, to be fair to him, good employer for me, because that was a townsman club. I did about 3 or 4 years there, and I end up with a house band. I end up in the house band as well.
Were you doing 7 nights a week now with 2 bands?
Yeah.
Wow.
So from worrying about what am I going to do, landed on my feet, you know. I mean, everything's gone like that for me in life, you know.
Good playing. You prefer kind of better playing in the other band?
Well, with the other band, totally different. Warren was a keyboard player, a jazzer. Play anything for anybody.
And this was the cabaret band? Cabaret.
And then I started playing for a lot of artists like Mark Monroe who were coming in and people like that. I was with them, and you know.
How many years did you say you were there?
I was townsman, let's see. 68, 69, 70, 71. 4 years in the townsman.
4 years, there you go. So who did you back in during those 4 years?
First 2 years, I was just with the Bobby Wayne band. And the next 2 years, then I had to do the 2 bands because Les, the drummer, with them, I learned a lot off again. He was an old school drummer like Jack I learned off in Minehead. I met another one here in Swansea, you know, took me under his wing, and I was learning so much off these guys. They'd done what I dreamt of wanting to do when I was a kid. They'd done it, like. Mm. And now I was doing it now. And they were passing it on to me. But things were changing, but I could go a bit more modern. And they could see I had this firing pair of hands. They said, "That's enough. That's enough now. You don't have to do any more with your hands," he said. "It's the knowledge now to go with that now."
And yeah.
You know, you'll always have work, you know. So somebody comes, you do pick up the brushes, you pick them up. Not say, "Oh, I don't do brushes." "You must do these things," he said. "And then he'll always work." And he went ill, very, very ill. So I started depping for him, first of all. Then the job came up, and they started wanting to push for another drummer in there, see, because they didn't want me messing from the other band. Because Ron, he owned me.
They didn't want you to do, Ron didn't want
he
you
didn't
to
like
do
it, you know. Yeah. But I was enjoying it, you know. And anyway, I did 2 years. I played for loads of people, loads of people.
Go on, give us a few.
I'd have to rack my brain. Like Selena Jones was a jazzer.
Right.
I can't think off the top of my head, but you know. But I guess there was one every week for 2 years.
Frank Sinatra's pianist, didn't you say he came in?
Oh, that was when I moved from another club. I'd gone from here then. That was Buddy Greco.
Buddy Greco, is it? Yeah.
Yeah. He was awesome. Awesome. He wasn't very nice as an individual to me at first, but he turned out all right in the end. I've got to watch what I say now, but...
it's only opinions.
It was brilliant what happened, because I'd left the townsman now, right? And the story about that was Ron, that's Terry's dad, who employed me in that box stand, left the townsman. And I went with him, and Bonnie Tyler came with us, and 3 of the girls... But the boy, he didn't. And we got this new club. And what I didn't know, Ron had got into the club under false pretenses, because the guy who owned the club was an ex-miner, came into a lot of money, right, on a private mine, inherited millions, I think. And his ambition was, one day, he knew the money was coming, one day, if I get all this money, I'm going to build a club. And he said, my ambition was, you were banned, not you, but... Ron's band with the girls at, were going to be my frontline band, he said. I was going to get all the big names here, Shirley Bassey, Tom Jones, he named all this, eh? And I thought, oh, he's dreaming, like, isn't he? He'd done it, didn't he?
Wow.
He'd done it. But the first night we opened up, There was no the guy. Have you heard of Alan Randall? He's a cabaret artist.
I own one of his ukuleles.
That's right, he's a ukulele guy. That's him.
Yeah, I've got one of his ukuleles.
George Formby man.
He's a George Formby guy, and yeah. I've got a golden ukulele that he had custom built in 1974.
Have you?
By a company called Kemp Tone.
How did you get that then? How do you know him?
Well, I didn't know Alan Randall, but I joined the George Formby Society because I love the stuff. And then I kind of got to know people. And when I was looking for a ukulele to use on stage, this one of his that he had custom ordered in the 70s came up. And I got it for a very good price because I'm a member of the society and they wanted it to go to the person wanted it to go to a good home and to somebody who was going to use it and appreciate it and have it.
Oh, nice.
And and I didn't really know Alan Randall much. I'd heard of him and I'd probably seen him on maybe Des O'Connor in the 80s when I was a kid or something on TV. I just could just picture him. I couldn't really. But what I found is there's some amazing footage of him playing George Formby songs. He's incredible. But what I didn't realise until I looked into him, he is a grade A high-level jazz guy that played vibraphone.
I was just going to tell you.
Yeah, and he's a high-end guy.
He's a nice guy as well.
Yeah, nice guy from what I can tell. But he made his money. Like, so playing jazz well doesn't necessarily make lots of money. So the George Formby meant that he could buy the Bentley and the big house and then he could do his other stuff as part of the show and, you know, scratch that itch from what I can tell.
Right. Yeah, well, he was the first artist at this brand spanky new nightclub opening. This is 1972.
Right? What was the name of the club? This wasn't the Townsman, he said.
This was called The Rainbow.
The Rainbow.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll never forget it because there's so many stories attached to this, I could talk all day long. The guy who owned his club was an ex-miner, like I said, right? He built it himself with his friends. Literally, hardly had any builders to do nothing, and it was second to none. The workmanship, we spent a lot of money there, right? And the carpenter, I always remember his name was Roger, and the electrician, I can't remember his name. I always remember this, right? Des was the owner, and our band was down there now 2 days before opening. I took my drums down and put on the riser and set up and do a little dock around, get the ambience of the place, ready for the opening night on a Saturday night. And I remember the boys walking in, covered in cement, and there was big frantic paintings going on last minute, things everywhere, checking this and checking that. Des comes out the office, in each hand like this, two black suits with all the dicky bows on hanger, see? And he goes, Roger, come here. He's a carpenter. What do you want? He puts it against him like that. Yeah, that's your size. Put it on. Phil was the next thing. Phil, put that on. What's that? Manager, under manager. Start on Saturday. Literally, right? It's like a 40 Tower sketch. Honest to God. And he walked away. And I'm standing there. I was talking to the boys. And I said, what's that? And I went, I don't know. And he said, I don't know. It sounds like you're the manager. You didn't give me orders. I said, I got to him, see? I don't give no fucking orders. I don't give no orders to anybody. And then all the banter, Saturday opens up. Roger was there, all fluted up. Phil was there. And it opened up like that. On the Saturday opening night, it was just us. And there's a lot of free guests and food trying to around the big contest. It's massive. It's a great night, actually. I enjoyed it. On a Sunday then, I had to go down at 3 o'clock, a band called Alan Randall. He walks in. And he looked a bit like George Formby. His teeth, he said his teeth done.
Wow.
He looked like Cardi. He told me afterwards, opening number, I had my music up there. It'll be blah, 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 blah. Alan Randall. I had. He wanted that, see? But like jazzy, like? Ron and Jorgen. Right? Now, when he's with us and Bonnie Tyler, brilliant. It could get a hide in the mix, but now it's just a different ball game. Mm. It's a different ball game altogether. You know what I mean? And it didn't get past two bars, And Alan said, oh, well, Scott, try it again, boys. Yeah. Okay. He knew straight away. And he looked at me, he didn't say nothing. And he turned to him, Ron, he said, is anything wrong? Ron said, who wrote this? And I'm starting to think, oh, no, I'm tuning already. I thought, oh, no. You know, and he said, well, actually, it's my own arrangement, he said, you know. But don't worry about it, he said. He's lovely bloke, lovely bloke. He knew this guy couldn't play now. No, don't worry about it. He took it off. Said, do you know the Saints go marching in, he said. And he said, yeah, any key. You played. Yeah. Okay. If you played what you wanted, it was an act, brilliant act. I could see it visually there. And there's something about drums that started coming up, and I was looking down, all oh, right, it's going to be interesting, it's like. And he came up on the bandstand down here, up in the rise, and he went, it's you and me, mate. So he said to me, and you're not the melody instrument. He said to me, and I said, no, I'll do my best. I know, he said, he patted me back. And then when Ron, you see, we took a break, because there's tension, awful tension in the air. Oh, so first night, with a cabaret artist, second night of the club opening, sold out.
How big was it? What was the capacity?
I can't remember. You know, thousands of seats, just, you know.
Big.
All seats all around, upstairs, balcony, glass front, full restaurant, three chefs. Oh, he done the works. All the people were coming down from London. A lot of them were coming straight from the Palladium. Big names on the Palladium on the Saturday, finishing, coming down with us on the Sunday. And he thought, ooh. Bloody Wales will be going to now, and they come in and go, oh, wow, yeah, you know, yeah. Not expecting it, like, you know. And coming back to this Alan Randall stunt, and it was, it's a bit embarrassing because I could see where it was going, and I'd been enough now on the road prior, working with, you know, musicians of all calibre, different things. I'd learned a bit of the craft, like, and I could see myself what was wrong, and I couldn't say nothing. It was myself, like, you know. And Alan got me on my own, and he said, the old guy in the organ, he said, is he anything to do? Is it your father or somebody? I said, what? Is he family? He said, there's nothing to me. I said, nothing. He employs me. Oh, he went, yeah, he went. So I can't go on, he said. I got no act. What can I do? That's my act, he said. And I wasn't expecting this. Des comes, all right, boys. And I didn't say nothing. So he said to Alan, was it anything wrong? Well, the guy in the organ, he said, he can't play. And Des, there was a guy who built this place, and his dream was to have us there. And having us there was talking to Ron, who was now letting him down. Mm. And he said, well, he's the best around here, he said. And he said, if that's the best, he said, I'm going back to London, he said. Why, he said, I can't go on. He said, you can't play for me. You can't get past the opener. And Des said, what's that? What do you mean? He didn't know he was talking about him. He didn't understand.
Yeah.
He was a plain, simple Welsh, old-fashioned miner. And he's in out his depth now in this world. He got to the point that I had to go on the phone and speak to people in London, you know, different agents about artists coming down and stuff like that. He didn't understand. And I said to Des, listen, Des, I said, the honest truth is, I said, Ron's a great keyboard player in the house band with us, I said. You saw it last night, it was rocking, wasn't it? Oh, brilliant, like, he said. I got pissed, he said, oh, I got pissed, he said. And he's all like that, you see? I said, yeah, I said. But now, I said, this is a different thing. I said, you've got artists coming out. I said, who's, can you show me a road? Who's coming? I looked, Freddie Starr, Selena Jones, you know, all these names I come through. I thought, oh my God, no. I said, won't you play for them? I said, no. Why? What's the difference then? I said, it's reading music. I said, it's another world. Well, I said, if you went out now as a musician, I said, it's you. You're different to the next guy. I said, yeah, people can't know everything, but if you've got music, they do know everything. That's how you do it, I said. It might not be the best, but at least you can get there. You can do something. And he didn't understand all that, super bugger. So he didn't want to offend the bloke, because then he said, oh, I'll pay him, he can go back to London. You know, because Des was a nice old boy, like, he didn't understand. You'll have to pay extra time, he said, I'll pay you, he said. But he said, I want to run a club. And but I won't go too much into that because it got nasty then between things, right? He went on the first night, the same did, and he stormed the place because he did Saints Go Marching In, and he did a tap dancing thing, and he just turned to me and I went tick, 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 tick. And we were making this up between us like telepathy.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And he was enjoying it, and you know, and he ended up clipping the drums by me, got another first thing, boom, boom, boom. I went doom 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 doom, copying it, and I go then. He said, "You go mental now." Then I went, and he goes, Because falls off the riser, crowd all cheering, so it's brilliant type of thing. See, something to the nothing. We got through the week. He thanked me, really, he bought me a lot of drinks, actually. He's a lovely bloke. And he said, wow, that was some experience, he said. I thought I'd seen it all. He said, it got to the point then, I think we got away with about 3 weeks in there. And I got home one night, it was pouring with rain, a horrendous night. And I just got in, and I was just about to go to bed, and the phone goes, and nobody phones me at the work. I've never had phone calls like that in my life. I just ran on the phone. And he said, Pete, he said, yeah, a bit of bad news. He said, but don't worry about it. He said, yeah, you've just been sacked. See?
You've just, or we've just?
We have just been sacked. I went, oh, no. Here we go again, I thought, you know. He said, I've had a falling out with Des. He said, he's demanding this, demanding that. He said, he doesn't know what he's doing and blah, blah, blah. And I put the phone down. Phone goes again. Des on the phone.
Yeah.
Pete, yeah. Listen, he said, I've got to tell you, but could you come and see me in the office in the morning? I said, I've had Ron on the phone. Well, you know, do you? Yeah, we've been sacked. No, you haven't, he said.
He's been sacked.
And it's worse than that, he got two blows or something. He had the two boys, knew his keyboards, his organ, which is a big, two, like his Hammond, and two Leslie speakers. He chucked them out in the car park in the pissing rain.
Wow.
What can you do with, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning like that? It's very bad, that was. Very, very bad.
Very bad.
I kind of felt sorry for Ron in one way, but Ron wasn't the guy you could deal with, like, you know?
Yeah, and if he's not good enough, he should have kind of...
Well, it was, well, like Des said, he said, he told me, I wanted the band, your band, to back the Cabarets. He said, we'll do that. He couldn't do it. So he was out, and I went to see Ron, and that's when Bonnie Tyler split. She went away. I went my way. I stayed in the club, and I got Warren and the bass player from the Townsman, who were doing a cabaret before down there, turned the place around with the same backing girls, all that. Wow, what a difference. What a difference. The band lifted, Cabarets. Everybody loved the amount of times we were offered to get on the, can you leave this club? Why, come on the road with us, you know, and all that, you know. It changed, you know.
Were you on good money now again?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've always earned good money, you know what I mean? I never been short, like, I never do. I didn't even. My hardest part was having to decide whether I stay where I am or what I, because you get fed up after a while, you know what I mean? The
yeah.
Routine of it and.
But the routine's a bit different if you're backing all these different stars. There's a different show every week, isn't it?
Well, that was good. That was good. Interesting, you know, sometimes, but other times it was, you know.
Yeah, and same venue.
And I'm not going to mention any name, but some of these stars, I was glad to get off the stage and go home, you know. They're in the fantasy world, like, you know. I don't like that, like, you know.
Yeah.
It's a bit false, like.
Any other stars you remember from that time or comedians or anything?
I played for the old Comedians Roadshow, the Comedians on Television, it's called The Comedians. Do you remember that?
No, I don't know. Said,
check it out, it's called The Comedians. There were 10 of them, 10, 15 of them. Des booked them all. He booked them all, right? And I got called in the office to Sky in London, and this guy said to me, who am I speaking to now? I said, I'm one of the musicians in the band. And he said, this guy, is he real? He said. Is he, no, Des, what is he to you? I said, well, he's kind of friendly, very, very friendly together. I said, but he's the boss, he owns the place. He owns it, yeah. He's just booked all of them. He said, I find it hard to book one of them out, he said. The fees, he's got a riding high. Freddie Starr, right? That was one of them. A week of Freddie Starr, 1973. My God, that was when he was at his height. He had his own TV show. He's doing his Tarzan routine on TV and all this, you know, 1973. And I said, well, yes, he's genuine. Okay. He booked the Peddlers. Have you heard of the Peddlers? No, the Peddlers, look them out. They were a musician's band. He booked the Peddlers. He booked then Buddy Greco. Was over. He said nobody booked Buddy Greco. He came over, he did the Talk of the Town or the Palladium, something like that, and your place. But he's paying the money, he said. And I said, well, yeah, he's genuine, you know. I said, okay.
Was he a good business, Pete? You know, so he's paying because he's got money from his family, but is he making money? You know, is it a busy happening jumping place now? So he's making money
every night, full.
Great. Well, he's yeah.
7 nights a week he'll come in there. Yeah. He's jumping on a Monday. Can you imagine a Monday? People come back to work on a Monday. Oh, I'm on the club. So and so is there. You know, I got to go down. And they come once. Oh, brilliant! Come twice. Come three times. You know, to see somebody famous, like, you know, that type of thing. Because I've got a cracking story there. I was on with Freddie Starr, right? And I've known Freddie Starr since the 60s because we were on the road up in the Black Lion and stuff like that up in Newcastle Emlyn. He was Freddie Starr and the Delmonts then. And yeah. I thought then he was going to be somebody because he had that front about him. But he's the vocalist, that's all. But every now and then he'd do something cheeky, you know. I thought, he's funny, yes, that guy's funny, like, you know. And yet, then I got Liverpool to play and then the Delmonts to play. No, go around the corner, see him again, like, and then overnight then, he became away from the band, like they did with the Black Sox. They wanted part, somebody could see something, and pushed him forward. And he became what we know now, Freddie Starr, you know? But other than that, he was just a guy on the road in the band singing. He was a good singer, actually.
I sent you the other podcast we did with Paul Smith. So Paul took over from you.
Of course, yeah, he played him, didn't he?
At the Rainbow, didn't he? Well, he worked there did a couple of months there, I think. After you left at the Rainbow, you are now, and Paul was on the like 10 years. I think it was slightly later. I think Paul did late 70s. I'll have to check that, but he did about 10 years with him. So yeah, so you guys cross over, yeah.
Yeah. Like I say that again, that you're talking about the early years again, wasn't it? This was 73 I was with him.
Yeah.
And I always remember this one. He didn't like this because Freddie was very, I didn't think he'd drink. I don't think he touched drugs or forgot, but he's a practical joker. He walked in for a band call, right? And Des was making a big fuss, wasn't he? Massive fuss now. Freddie Starr, oh, big one. All tickets sold 7 nights, he said. I could do 2 shows, but he won't. He said, you're supposed to do 1 a night, like, say. Okay. Food coming out now, rolls, coffee. This is a band call. Normally, you don't have this sort of stuff, you know what I mean? Mm. Stuff coming out. And then also, then Des goes to drink his coffee. Goes like that, puts it down, looks at everybody and Roger and all is all there. Somebody's right. I said, what's the matter there? Gets his spoon. He wouldn't go in the coffee. All the time we've been there, do the sugar things, and there's still like a funnel on them with a little hole. Have you ever seen them?
Yeah.
In the 70s, you know, all the cafes and stuff. Freddie had this, you know, it's like a pound of sugar in there, right? He'd be going to guess, pour it in his coffee, they can talk, and everybody's all mesmerized with all these stories. Like, they're all gone, right? You put get another one in. It's all dissolving in this coffee like that. It's full of sugar. That's just, he thought it was hilarious. See? So that's our first, Des' first meeting with him. So Des now is putting him up at the house. Now, Des's house was up the street about within walking distance. It was like one of these houses, like a little mini mansion. And you go in, there's a massive big staircase, and it goes left and right with doors off it all around and coming down here, like, you know. You see in the movies. Lovely place, like, you know. And his wife was totally opposite to him. He was a raver, you know, out in the bars and pissed up and hard worker and built this place. She was church. Everything was church and prim and proper. No swearing. Wipe your feet and you come into the door. And Freddie Starr was staying there with him. What a mistake. Des comes in one day. He says, oh my God. I've got to find somebody to live. He said, why? She chucked me out. Do you know what that bastard did last night? She gone to a church meeting. So comes in through the door. Freddie was in his underpants, up on the top of the stairs like that. And he said, hey, is there a toilet downstairs? And she goes, oh, yes, she said. And he pisses over the bulk. He said, well, put that in there. No, he's at his heyday now. And he was mental. Right? And that's what he said to her. She went berserk with, not with him, but with Des. She said, you're going to get that man out of this house. No. So he had to go to the hotel now in Swansea. Right? That was one thing that happened. Second story was about this in 1 week. My car was jammed in at home. I couldn't get out, see? So I had a rally car up in my garage, lock-up garage, so I had to get that out and take it down to work. Now, this is geared out for rally, it's just got a roll cage in it, 2 seats, fire extinguisher in behind, and you're going to put your foot down and get it going to start. So I just rolling down there, and I was late getting in the car park. And I come in the car park, like it's around the back, and it's like dirt track car park. We belonged to the club. I came ripping in there. I went straight for the building I got, and I went, don't run it, I parked it backwards like that, see? I got the car. Freddie Starr was standing in now with a couple of bolts having a fart, like that. And he goes, fuck you there. Do it again, he said. I said, well, do it again, he said. Can you run again? That was jammy. I said, no, I said, go on. So I'm in the car and I did a couple of donuts around the car. Oh, he'd blown away like that. 2 days later, he gets a car, he was riding high now on telly, big time, and so the massive checks coming in, right? He takes delivery of his American car. It's automatic. And there's something like a V8 engine in it. And he says to me, through the car then, yeah. See the donuts then? I said, that, yeah. Brand spanking new car. Well, you know, worth, I don't know what it's worth. And the paintwork was, oh, like a Rolls Royce paintwork with glitter in it, like, you know, something.
Wow.
This world. And I had to try and do donuts with this car in the car park. And of course, that story got to London because I was out in Link, being all right, I was out in Spain on holiday with Gwyneth, right? And Paul Melba, who's a comedian from Liverpool, he was on at this club. And I played with Paul Melba at the start at this club, also with Freddie Starr being now in Wales. And I didn't know Paul Melba and him were friends, so I knew they knew each other because they're both from Liverpool. So I went in to see Paul Melba now, and he went, ah, he said, Melody Club. How are you, man? And he's shaking hands and said, blah, blah, blah. We're having a beer, junior. And something came about then. He said, well, Freddie Starr, see? So I said, oh, Freddie, I said, we go back a long way to the rock and roll days. I said, but I said, he came to the club after you, I think, or before you. I'm not sure now. I said, I told him, but was that you with the car? He said, yeah. Oh, you heard about that. The roadie told me, he said, yeah, you're doing donuts with his Pontiac or something. He had, he said, do what he did with me, he said. I live one up high, right, at a night off, and there's lawns off the road, and he parks the cars off there. There's a knock on my window. I thought, how can he knock on my window? I'm a story up. It was him standing on a box on the roof of his car, knocking the window to Paul. Hey, are you coming out? He thinks that's funny. Look at the lawn, it's all chewed up. Look, the caretaker go ballistic the next day. We've been driving a car over the lawn, like that was Freddie.
Yeah.
Huh? And Paul Melba was a very good actor. Check him out. He was the only one's clever to play for. You think you could play for him because he's a comedian, but he's a mimic. He puts on voices and takes off people. And you've got to capture the cat with the music and the person that he's taken off. Can't, you know, try and make it up. If you read the music and give it the right feel, and Warren was good, I guess, this week Warren was a great sight reader and a great player. And say you said, let's say Alan Randall, say you said George Formby, you know, in his mind, so he'd have that in his playing, like.
Mm.
All right? And if the next guy comes along and it's Vera Lynn, we'll meet again, he wouldn't be the same with it.
Yeah.
He's got that feel in his playing. And playing for guys like Paul Melman, people like that, I found that challenging at first, and I got into it. It's something, another learning curve. Because if you say, oh, anybody play for a comedian, you play him on, play him off. Not true. Because the other one was, he came for a week, and I'll never forget this, so for a different reason. I used to go in to the hospital there. My mother was seriously dying with cancer, you see. This was 1972. And I did a rehearsal with Bob Monkhouse, yeah. I wasn't a fan of Bob Monkhouse, being funny, but as a person, I think he was smarmy. He came in, did a band call us, right? Sunday band call, walked in, and he said to us, hi, guys, I'm Bob, you are, and he put his hand out, I'm Pete, and you are Warren, you are, you know, Adrian, right? And as he was, and he knew your name straight away. It could be 40 of you there, he'd remember your name. Yeah, what a brain on a bloke. Right? Mm-hmm. I said, right, can you do this, guys? I'd be happy to do this. He opened out. Round and round and round and round. He's having fun, having fun. Ginger Jack cut. Bob goes, yes, Bob says that. Bob is funny. The guy said, we went like. And he went, good, great. And he said, wonderful. He said, there's two ways. And Warren being cheeky, always, I wouldn't say nothing. I never spoke much to anybody, you know, I was buckled, say nothing. And he said, two ways of doing this. He said, I'd like to do this. He said, because it's a parody. And I mess about it. I go home, I write a lot, and I might change it. I might find out what's in the locality here and change it and blah, blah, blah. He said, see, you guys can play that. He said, I can do that. He said, that could be 5 minutes long, it'd be 20 minutes long. And I appreciate it, he said. So you can go to the bar when you come in every night and have a drink with me. Don't abuse it, lads, and we'll have fun. Thank you. And Warren said, well, what do you say the two ways? What's the other way? Ah, the other way is, you can't do that for me, he said. So you play me on, play me off, and you don't have a drink. He said, I can't. And I thought that was funny. And of course, on our contract, we do have a contract in that place, see, was no depths. No depths. Mm. No, because depths can mess a thing up, you see, no matter how good you are. But it's, sometimes it's unavoidable. This particular night, Bob Monk used to come in such a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, but a Wednesday. He used to come in. Hi, guys. All right. Always say hello. Do his act. And he had a guy with him waiting outside the door, in the car, gone. Gone. Look at. No chance to talk to him. And this night now, my mother passed away. I stood in for an hour to the hospital, leave the bed and go to work. And she passed away. And I went to work because everybody said, there's nothing you can do, you know. That's what she'd be happy. Like, you know. So I did. I went to work. But I slowed down. I was looking down again. And he said something funny about me. And the crowd all laughed. And I was looking, I missed it, you know. And Warren heard it, see. And Warren said to him when he came off, do you know who said that to Pete? He said, Pete's mum died tonight, just before he came to work. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So he sent for me up the dressing room. Now he's out that door, normally. Out that door. And I learned a lot. He said to me, he apologised for what he said. I said, well, I didn't hear you, Bob, anyway. Oh, no, man, he said. And I found, and he's, what are you drinking? He found out I was drinking anyway, because the drink was already up in the dressing room for me. Right? And we're drinking it. We talked for about a good hour. Good hour. And he told me about his, when he goes out the door every night, he's going home to his own child, an handicapped child he had. I didn't know. I didn't know that at all. You know, I'm not supposed to know that, what enemy is. But that's why he was doing it. And I saw a side of him. He didn't go home at night. He stayed in the hotel. He never talked to me. Apologised. He didn't need to do that. He didn't, you know, he didn't do nothing to me. You know what I mean? But, and I can really think of when he's not smarmy. It's how he is. How he portrays himself. And talking in his restaurant one-to-one like we were here for an hour. A lovely bloke. A lovely bloke. You know? But I'll go back to one. Can I jump back to one?
Yes. Yeah,
sure. Ricky Valance. He's the first pop guy I played for. Tell All I Love Her. Oh, my God. 1961 or 62 when he was in the charts. I went to play for him, and I was with the Blackjacks. And one of the many that we backed us, the Blackjacks. And he came in and he said to me, who's the drummer? I said, oh, Pete. Have you got brushes? I said, yes. Oh, you know what they are, do you? And I went, yeah, okay. Now, tell all, it's like this. Okay, in the studio. Mike, don't be here. Now, I've been around the block enough now, in 61, to think, nah, that's not going to work. 400-500 people in the hall, all screaming girls, just screaming girls in those days, and he wasn't playing with brushes. I think he's wrong. He was very offensive, very nasty to me, like, coat on his shoulder, medallion, all the guy, right? And I saw he could sing. All the rest of the sing was Mack the Knife and stuff like that. He's going to die in his ass now. This is 1961. Our band is just going to go on and play all this rock and roll and stuff that they wanted. Ladies and gentlemen, Ricky Valance. Screaming goes in front. All he wants is tell Laura. And in the middle of it, he goes, sticks. Sticks. And I kept going with brushes. I thought, bugger you, mate. You really had a go at me when you came in. But that was him. Right. That was 61. After I left the Black Sharks, 67, when I was on freelancing, right, I had a gig with him again up in Port Albert. And I had to bring a keyboard player. And I said to the keeper player, who's second to none, but he's very nervous. So I said, I don't know where this is going to go now. I said, well, this guy's mellowed. It's been 6 years ago I played with him. And he was an arse to me, I said. But this time I said, don't worry about it. I'll take charge. I've grown up a bit myself now. So I walked in, Ricky. I went, oh, hi, he said. I remember you. See, he did. And I said, where from then? So I thought, I'd test him. Where from? He said, you played for me at the Regal in Estelavera. I said, that's right, yeah. What a night that was, he said. Wow. Everyone's so excited. He said, yeah, yeah. And he said, he really kissed me. What's the keyboard player like? I said, oh, he's great. No problem. So what I found out now was, all his bravado with him and brushes and you know what it was. It was him. He was a bundle of nerves. Mm-hmm. None. It was him. And he had to go to somebody else to...
Yeah, yeah.
That kind of thing. And he picked on the keyboard player. And the keyboard player started going to bits. I said, I'll have a break. And I went now to the keyboard player. I said, oh, he's going to go home. I said, no. I said, hang on. I'm going to have a word with him now. I said, he's out of order. There's nothing wrong with your playing. It's him now. It's him. It's him showing his nerves. So I went to, I said, hey, Ricky, I said, what's wrong with him? Ah, he's okay. Like, but I said, no, it's not Ricky. I said, it's the best you can have. Do you want to go on tonight? He said, you've got 1 hour. The place is opening because he's going home. Oh, there's no need for that. I said, can I suggest you go and apologise to him? And he did. He went on, right? He went on a storm with Tell Laura and a couple of songs, but died in his arse for the rest. So he knew it's him. He didn't have an act, a full act, you see?
Yeah.
And, of course, I brought him to Carmarthen in the 80s, 82.
Well, yeah, let's move on to that. So what highlights from the 80s, what happened then?
Well, a lot of happened in my life up until then, from 79 to 82. But I'd finished with the bands, house bands and stuff, the guys who were these artists. I was back on my own, and I was forming a band, what I call Blackjacks Mark II.
Right.
See? I did that. That was 1982. And I had a residency in the Park Hotel in Carmarthen, yeah? I got friendly with a guy who was a businessman. And his wife's name is Laura, right? And he's on about, tell Laura. I said to him, why are you singing that? And he said, it's my wife's name. It's her favourite song. I said, I know that guy well. What, the guy who sang that? Yeah, no, you don't. This is what I get now, see? And I say, yeah, how can I know him? See? Because they don't know him. And I said, well, I do. I said, do you want to see if I can get in a company hotel? Oh, my God, what a night that was. What a night. I was on the ledge of my window here. I was sitting on the window to make no drum stool. My drums are up, I guess, and right on my bass drum, the bloke was putting his pint on my bass drum. I said, don't do that, it's going to fall off. It's round, man. Oh, it won't be there long, I'll drink it, he said. That's the level of the conversation I had. But they're all going to guess, tell Laura. And he's upstairs now, waiting to come on at 10 o'clock. This is 7 o'clock at night. Everybody's howling drunk. Where is he? Tell Laura. I would have to see him. He's packing his case, he's going to go. He's crapping himself. I'm not going down to that mob, he said. I said, I tell you one thing, I said, nobody will touch you in here. If somebody touches you, I said, you'll end up in hospital. You've got the right guy, you've got the hard guys here, but everybody's like a family, honest. Anyway, he came down, he looked at the door, but just mental there. And then this guy in, he was a hard case, and I just found out, I only found out a fortnight ago, he's passed away. If I ever see him town, he's in his mobile wheelchair, right? Wherever I see him, and this is from 82, he goes, tell Laura, I love her. We're in the queue once. Goodness, I in Tesco's, right? I mean, Christmas time, it's big queues. Next minute, he looks at me, oh, Jimsy, tell Laura, I love her. And he's telling all the people in his queue, all strangers, see him with him, play some on the stars, he does, he knows them all. He said, tell Laura. I go, security. You're talking about comedians, right? Once surprised me, what's his name? Alf Garnett.
Alf Garnett, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he came down for a week down in anyway, he comes along, and it's a bit of an in story, really. We didn't know till he arrived that he wanted a piano out on the floor. We didn't know. And the only piano he had was in one of the bars, which was round the block, 10 blokes carrying his piano across the car park to put on the thing. Nobody looked inside it, right? Come to play it in the night. Warren jumps off the keyboards, goes down on it to play for him on the floor. opened it up. Inside was a chicken. A chicken from the restaurant. Put it inside the piano. The wire chicken. We don't know to this day. Warren picks us up. Of course, half garnet, and he turns that into a joke. But when he came to us, right, he didn't do any of the half garnet. What's his real name now? Warren, something Warren, isn't it? Warren Mitchell, is it?
You Warren Mitchell, yeah.
Yeah, Warren Mitchell. It's coming to me now, yeah. When he walked in, he was a posh-talking gentleman.
He was?
Very posh-talking gentleman, yeah. And he didn't do any elf garnet thing until he was telling his life story and we were playing some songs, he was singing old-time songs in the musical. And quite hard to play for some of these guys, you see, because it's a lot of chop and changing. You know, it's no good faking it. You've got to be... So there, like, when he wants it, and then Warren goes on the floor on his piano, and he puts his piano. That's when he went into his elf garnet. Now, we don't know. Did he organise for the chicken to be in there so that he could go into his elf garnet, see?
Mm.
With his chalk and cheese. He was posh-talking on it. And every came here to see him as elf garnet. You know? And the other one I played for, it's quite hard to play for, Max Wall.
Oh, yeah.
Him. Now, he came down for a week in the Towns one, and we used to go off then doing moonlighting at the clubs afterwards, late night cabaret on somebody else's club, like, you know. And he took me, Warren, and Adrian, we used to do that. Difficult to play for. You could be on the ball, and because you might think it's a comedian, but it's not, it's slapstick, like, you know. It's like playing for a circus guy. He might turn around in the middle of a joke, right round, like, and twist his legs, and you go, and you might miss it, like, and he'll tell you afterwards, I wanted that, man, you know. It is funny when I do it, but that really makes it funny.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're having lessons of people to play for.
Yeah.
He's a, you know, interesting guy, nice guy to play for.
We could talk about people who've, hopefully people are getting that impression now, but we could talk about...
I got another 149 to it.
Yeah, exactly, I know, and it's amazing, and I would love to hear... all, but we can't go on forever. So
I know.
I could hear, like, maybe we'd have to do it another way. I could hear just hour after hour after hour of these, like, cabaret kind of days, mm-hmm. and these people, because it's just fascinating. It shows a side of these people that were, you know, household names, and you're talking about what they were like off camera, and that's a really nice glimpse into a whole type of show business, which sort of is, you know, it does exist, but not in the same way now. It's really fascinating.
So the last bit I wanted to do in this section was Martin's got a guitar that belonged to someone pretty famous that that you met once, Pete. So if we do that story, and then we'll go on to your drum collection.
Who's the guitar belong to?
I'll let you take it, Martin.
Well, okay. So I bought a guitar quite a while ago, which used to belong to Peter Green, and he's probably... one of the probably top five people that I was really into when I started playing bass guitar. And then I now bought a Peter Green guitar. And then we turned up at your house a while ago when we were on tour, just to call in and say hello. And you start telling us a story about Peter Green coming to record in your studio.
Right. Well, it happened out of the blue, because it should have been Terry Williams on drums, right?
What year, roughly?
I'm not sure. No, this is 90s.
Right.
Well, what happened is this guy came down here, and cut a long story short, I ended up being the drummer for his album he's going to do. And he's name dropping all these people like Leo Sayer. He's going to do the title track. He did do it, yeah. He said he had Pete Green coming down, do some guitar with him. And he's talking to me like as casually as I'm talking to you now. And I'm going, yeah. And then the next guy he mentions, and he said, I got Eugene Hideaway Bridges, which I didn't know. I said, who's he then? Oh, I said, I worked him out in Texas. He's American. He said, he's coming over. He's putting down some tracks. So I said, so what's this album, man? Oh, I wrote all these songs myself. He said, I put in the band together. Mark Knopfler's giving me a guitar, he said. So it got worse the more he said. I just thought, guy, like, you know. So I said to Phil, who's a local guy with me, the bass player, I said, what, do you know this guy? And he said, no, I said, he's just appeared from nowhere. But he seems to be, you know, seems to know all these people. There's something about him, I don't know what. We couldn't figure it all out anyway. But anyway, a guitar, he did have a guitar come here, and I assume it was Mark Knopfler's, because all the rest of the things he said were true. This guy, had a phone call from the station. There's a guy down here, he said. I couldn't watch all say this now, because he said he's a bit spaced out. He said he's sitting on the seat. He doesn't know where he is, he said. He tried to, you know, to talk to this guy, and he's not very coherent. He doesn't know what's going on, like. And I thought, I put two and two together. He said, I know, I've been tweeted. Does he know anything about it? So this guy, knowing me as a musician, said about this guy now. And I said, I don't know. I said, what's he? I didn't know he's coming here, like. See, but he put him on to me, get to Carmarthen in, and get to my house. You see? Like he did with Eugene Bridges. That, he turned up at the station. And this guy again on the station, I taught his son drums. He's the station master guy. I taught his, and he knows me well, like. And he said, I got an American guy here, he said. And he's got a piece of paper in his hand. He said, it's your house, he said. And I'm not expecting this, you see. Nobody's told me this. And I said, right. So what shall I do? I thought, I'll come down now. I said, I walked down, and it's this black American. Hi, Eugene Hardaway Bridges, he said. Told me to get in touch with this guy. Well, that's me, I said. He tells me you're going to be putting me up, he said, and you got the studio. And I hadn't done anything like that. Nothing like it at all, like, you know. So anyway, so just Pete Green, this is him. Then who else turned up? Oh, a guy who was the piano player, who, as we speak right now, he's playing for Tom Jones.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He picked up with Tom Jones, and I'm not surprised. He deserves it. He's such a great player. And then we got through this album.
Just to summarise, this guy said he was getting all these musicians to come and play at yours, and you thought he was bullshitting it, but then some of them turned up at the station without you knowing, and you had to pick them up.
That's exactly what happened.
Was Peter Green.
That's exactly what happened. But I don't know what happened to Peter Green. I don't know where he ended up or what happened to him. I really don't know.
He wasn't on the album?
No. As far as I know, no. Then somebody else was coming on the frame. I had a piece of... I saw these the night, because do you know what I told you about it? I did all the recordings here, the rehearsals, right? But we went up to Flach up in North to do the main taping, right? Then he took the reels up to London for the mastering. And then waiting for him was Paul Jones. He's doing the radio blues thing.
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. These are names that I picked up off YouTube myself now, because I didn't know about it, right? My name's not on there. Phil's name's not on there. The Brass Boys' names are not on there. These are the people that are actually on the album, and I know they're on them, right? Paul Lamb, Keith Dunn, Leo Sayer, Mike, somebody see them? Sonny White, I think he's American. Eugene Hardaway Bridges, Earl Green, and a guitarist who'd been doing things with the Rolling Stones called Mick Taylor.
Oh, Mick Taylor, yeah.
Yeah. They're on the album.
Have you heard the recordings? Do you know if you are on the album or not?
Oh, I know I'm on the album. Phil said. I said to Phil, have you got a copy of it? Phil's got a copy. I haven't. I've never heard it. All swearing and the arguing, the whole bits. Eugene had a real ego, fill a room, right? The opening night, we played down in the Esso Club, right down on the bay, Pembroke. Quite a big club. And he just arrived in the afternoon, Hammond organ player. I can't remember his name. His name's not on there. It's awful. It's terrible they do things like that. Anyway, he turned up, right? Hammond C3 player. Him, me, drums, Phil, Corny, full brass section. Leo Say wasn't there. There's a couple of guys. Earl Green, he was there. Anyway, there was a set list with his album scattered in between. And the guy who's on it now, Todd, he says, right, you just play me on. With what then? Just a blues thing, anything. So this guy went, on his Hammond. I thought, wow, what a sound. He was really digging in and chatting. So I went, all mic'd up, he sounded tremendous. This is good on, the crowd loving it. Nothing happened, no. This guy, you know, who's in charge of the album, comes out, his guitar, cigarette burning and stuck on a wire at the top, waving to the audience, big time. We all looked at each other, oh my God. Now, he could play, don't get me wrong, he could really, really play, but what an ego.
Mm.
Oh, and was it Eugene come on then? Oh, yeah, I did, like, it was... He sang as born and as I was born. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant, right? That was the first night we did Rock Him. The album came out, didn't send me a copy or nothing, but I think he took the ump in me, see, because he came here with an attitude. There's only one drummer in Wales, but when he came that night and I was playing with my band there, and he said, oh, do you know you play drums? I said, yeah, so I am a drummer. Oh, you can do the album for me then. I said, we talked, you know?
Okay, right, you've got an extensive Ludwig drum collection as part of the thing I've known you for, and probably the reason I started collecting Ludwig, well, definitely the reason I started collecting Ludwigs, because you had them. So how many did you end up with at the height, full kits?
60-ish.
60-odd full drum kits, which is amazing.
Yes.
Well, nearly exclusively Ludwigs. And it all started with your first one, which you got when?
I bought the Blue Sparkle when I was down in Minehead in 62, towards the end of the season. I bought it in Plymouth, and then that came in off the boat to a music store, Clark and Chin. I can't remember that now, Clark and Chin, Plymouth music store. And he brought it to the camp because he couldn't insult him. He came on to me. All those years I've been playing as a kid, I never had a drum kit or borrowed kits. And then go back to the Blackjack story again. They dressed me and they got me my kit.
And in Ajax, I believe.
In Ajax, yeah, black Ajax, yeah. Yeah, that's my first kit. I remember where that place is, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's Pontyberem.
Is it Pontyberem, where I did all my music courses?
When you did music things there, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
That's Pontyberem stage. And when I left there, in my Blue Sparkle, I had a blue canister. Pontyberem, I left it.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, just shit, it's useless. No, they're worth about £500-600, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
I left it, it's useless.
so that kit, but if I remember right, it stood out to you, and it was like, no one else had a Ludwig at this time, because it was American.
Well, I don't say that, really. Okay. Everywhere I was going, people were telling me that, but they must have been, because there was no Ludwig's franchise over here. I think Drum City had it first, and I think that was like, 63?
There was, like, through the 50s, there was, like, an embargo against, say, America to import, which was meant to stimulate British yeah. manufacturing. So, and it's why there's a lot of contention about Fender guitars and stuff. So if you imported one, you paid high tax. So my guess is there would have been American drum kits, but they would have been in tiny numbers and they would have been very expensive to import. And then I think, I don't remember if it was 59 or 60 that embargo was lifted.
Yeah.
So you'd have been one of the first for sure.
Well, what happened with mine was my kit was actually 1960. So it was second hand technically. The guys used to go out on the liners, take a premier, because the Yanks wanted the premier kits. They loved them. Mm. Like we loved the Gretches and the Leedys and Ludwigs coming from there. So they take that out, swap it, bring the Ludwig back.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would make a little bit of money each way on them, see? Mm. So that came into the shop and he came on to me and took me back a bit because I was so chuffed to that Ajax. Remember, I never had a kit in my life. That was my first kit. And he said to me, you look like you could do with a new drum kit. Come out to the audience, like that to me. And normally people say, can you play so-and-so? Or do you know so-and-so? You look like you could do with a new drum kit. I thought, what do you mean? It threw me like. I said, what do you mean? He said, I got a nice drum kit. He said that you can have. It's an American drum kit, Ludwig, he said. and I do it at Ludwig through movies and things like that, like not through bands. Everybody was, you know, Ringo now. Ringo is Ludwig. He kept, he rescued the Ludwig company. But I said, all right, I got a break in 10 minutes. He said, where are you? I'm sitting at the back, he said. I'll see you now. I said, come off. So he had this West Country accent. I said, where are you from, man? He said, I'm from Plymouth. I said, this band is from Plymouth. I knew, he said, I thought so, the Black Jacks. He said, the regional drummer, he mentioned him. He said his name. Anyway, cut a long story short. He said, come on down, he said. So I went down to Plymouth. I took one look at the kit. Oh, I thought, I've got to have this. It looked something, you know. They're playing it. It just looked something. So I don't remember if I traded mine in. I don't remember what happened to my kit. I really don't. It's funny that of all things in my memory, I can't remember what I did with it. Anyway, that was 1962. I had a...
And that kit went out to top 10 with you?
Yeah. It got hammered.
Yeah, imagine all the people that played that.
Played the shit out of that. Oh, my God. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, a month. Oh, my God. It's lucky it survived.
Yeah. And then I think you went... So then when did you start getting more?
I'd almost finished with the Black Charts when I bought a Black Oyster. I just bought it. And luckily I bought it because I needed two by the time I left the Black Charts because we were doing things like... I remember doing the Black Charts. We did the opening of the Aberavon Lido up in Aberavon. And the Queen was there for the grand opening. And we were the band representing Wales. And in the night, it was a Dixieland band, Sid Phillips band, that's it. And what we did, we set up the Black Oyster in a nightclub in Port Talbot for late night cabaret. And I did three gigs that day. I did the opening of the thing for the Queen, the Lido. Then we did the Workman's Club, an hour spot on off, gear in the van, down to the nightclub, padlocked all the van, upstairs, had my black my blue ones in the van, Black Oyster upstairs waiting for me, and I did three gigs in one day.
So then what made you decide to collect more?
Well, later on then things got very heavy for me with sorting gear out. Upstairs, two flights of stairs up, turn up, was the Townsman Club, where I was playing for all those artists I told you about earlier on. Saunchy Sound had opened up their radio station and they do live recordings in there. And I did a few albums of different people in there for different things.
I never knew that, actually. I never knew that.
Yeah, and I couldn't hump this kit down. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning, all people trying to get out of a club. So I had my Black Oyster in there, right? So my two kits were taken care of. And then there's moonlight in the club with Ashley. Third drum kit came into it then. So I bought another Ludwig, Blue Oyster. So Blue Sparkle, Black and Blue Oyster, and there were three working kits. And I carried a Blue Oyster in the boot of the car for months doing moonlighting in from other gigs. But then I thought one day, I saw a catalogue of all the colours. I never looked at Ludwig in full flow, like, you know, all the history of the family, nothing. I started reading it. I thought, interesting.
So you ended up with nearly every colour, was it?
I did.
There's some really rare ones that you might have had, or do you want to, I mean, so basically nearly every colour you could think, if anyone knows a Ludwig's, then you'll know all the hundreds of wraps they've got. Do you think you've ever had a salesman?
I have had a salesman, yeah.
Now that's super rare. There's only like a handful.
But you know what? The stupid thing with the salesman was me. It looked nice, but it looked to me like it reminded me of a fairground, happy, chippy, you know? So I saw that, and now I realize everyone I've sold is valuable. I bought that in Germany. I was on a tour over in Germany with the band, and I saw it in the shop. I bought it.
The salesman?
And I posted it back home myself. Wow. Boxed all up and posted it back home.
You've had a couple of like citrus mods and the pink oysters. And
I've had them all, yeah.
Any other kits that stand out to you that were like, you know, ones you're really glad you had?
Well, I tell you, Dave Munden, he's passed away now, probably this year. I've been friends with Dave when he's in his 60s. Tremolo's drummer. Now, he had he had two Ludwigs that I bought of him. And I think you've got one of them. Black one?
Yeah, you said, yeah, supposedly. There's no, I haven't got any authenticity of it, is it? But like,
That's it. That's Dave's black. That one came from Dave. Yeah. And I've got you a blue sparkle belonging to him. The blue sparkle I bought through a friend who knew I collected, and it came with authentication papers on the original from Edward Tremors on the front. That's and cool. Dave's names on it, which he signed everything with a paint. So I rung Dave. The guy didn't know I knew him personally. So I rung Dave and I said, "Your kit, would you know it?" "No, anyway, Mike, why? What, tell me about it." And I said, "So, and it's two little studs we pushed in. They were like they take the dampers out,
yeah,
because they rattle when they're recording." And that's very much recorded at us. He said to me, "I think he's done about six number ones, chart number ones, five or six albums. That was my favourite kit," he said. I said, "Why did you get rid of it then?" "Oh," he said, "you know what it's like, man, when you need money." I thought, "Tremors need money, you know? One day you're up, Mike, next you're down," like, you know, I thought, yeah, okay. And then I went up to meet him and I came back with the black one. I said, "Do you know what is there?" "Just up in the attic of his garage." He said, "Get it down," he said. And I went up, I climbed up and passed it down, opened the case. He said, you know,
yeah. It's behind me now, yeah.
Well, that's Dave's. And that I got that one, and that's very, and I got letters and everything after it. The other one I got then is Derek Price. Have you YouTubed Derek Price yet?
Tell us the story. Yeah, this is the one I was going to bring up. So yeah.
Well, Derek, I didn't know who Derek was actually. I'd heard of his name back in the 60s, right? And then it had gone out of my brain. The whole of my drumming, I never crossed past him or nothing. But Derek was great. He did the Goon Show, which I used to listen to in the 50s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He was on the Goon Show doing all effects and stuff like that. He's more of a studio and film set drummer. And he worked a lot with Ronald Hazelhurst, you know, blankety blank, blankety blank, blankety blank, blankety blank, all that, and doing little ditties like that. And he was with a Latin band as well. I can't remember which one it was now. But anyway, that was a cracker because that was on eBay. I don't buy, I don't sell on there, nothing. Anyway, I was looking at it one day. For sale, 60s Ludwig, I am selling for my friend. Oh, warning lights, selling for a friend, you know. Yes, and it said, my friend bought this in the 60s for a film set at Abbey Road, blah, blah, blah. He's played on numerous albums, Petula Clark, Downtown. I thought, I've played that. Black Jacks, I was singing, girl singer. That's the drummer. Drums, Anna Ludwig, Champagne Sparkle, Cases, Cymbals.
Wow.
The time stood still. I still got all there anyway, Cases and all. And he said, I said it for my friend. He was involved with the Goon Show. It's like the Who's Who of London through the 50s. And I thought, wow, who the hell is this guy? Didn't mention him, see? And he said, I think it was £1,200 or something.
Whoa.
I said,
that's underpriced even just for a Ludwig.
Well, you know, it should have been £2,000 for Joe Bloggs' kit. It's a champagne spark with a 400 snare, Keystone badge. Oh. Right? So I thought, scam. With this bottle, she came in, she said, yeah, but look what it says at the bottom. Look, the buyer must come to London and meet the drummer. Which is unusual. So I thought, boom, press buy. I bought it. This is 11 o'clock at night. Anyway, me, Frank, and Gwyneth drove up, got to the house. I said to Gwyneth, drop me off here now. I won't be long. You go down to Gail and come back in 20 minutes. So she went down and said, I walked in the house. Let's say just 10 o'clock in the morning. Got there. 10 o'clock at night, I'm still there. It's like we're talking now. We had so much in common, and he was so pleased as I was having the kit. He couldn't believe it. And I had in the car, as happened the night before, I didn't put it in there. I had a magazine write up that I had with my collection. It had just come out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I showed him, and he's looking at the, and he's looking at me, and he goes, so, is that you, Billy? I said, yeah. Wow, he calls his wife, and she's got this. She was a star. And he was a gentleman with a tie on. And Sunday morning, at, you know, at the office, like, a gentleman, he was a lovely bloke. And anyway, he had tears in his eye. Because he opened his scrapbook, it was all black and white. And in there was a photo of him and this guy on the piano, and again, the piano turning around the Gatsby. And I went, oh, I know him. And he looked at me and said, how do you know him? And in my brain, I said, I know him from somewhere. And I couldn't think, see? Oh, and he didn't say nothing. So, you know, and then, next one he turned over was him fighting on the floor with Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan rolling on the floor. So we took a shot of it, black and white. I said, what's that then? Well, I saw on the Goonstone set for the radio. I said, oh, I used to love that. I said, what were you doing after then? I was with Ray Ellington, drummer, right, and his band, and I was doing all percussion and stuff like that for the Goonstone. And he said, do you know what, is a lot of junk in the boxes that I'm giving you, he said, but it's all stuff, they don't need it anymore today. They do it on a keyboard, he said. I don't think it's the same, he went.
Yeah.
And he showed me a symbol, right? And it just, oh, it looked like it's been tied to the back of your car and driven from Leeds to Scotland and back, bouncing on the floor. It looked like shite. And he said, hit it. He went, he said, that's an opening sequence. He said, you're burning Breslau. He comes through the beads, I guess, and carry on up the Casbah. And the carry on film. I said, we did it in those days, he said. We did have a bloke going, that'd been invented. Great talking to him.
Yeah, and then, amazing. Then, and you've still got that one, haven't you?
It's all in the boxes up there. And I said to him about different bands and stuff he played with. And he was very interested in me because there's stuff, you know, what have you done? And I mentioned, he said, I played all the artists in the clubs like all the other drummers do. He said, no, they don't, he said. I said, no, they don't. He said, that's rare. He said, these artists, they got their own people going around them. And he said, yeah, so who are you? Like artists, people like Selena Jones. Selena, he said, yeah. She lives down the road there. He said, she's a friend of mine. And then he was bugging me about that photo, see? And then I said to him, man, Matt Monroe, I was with Matt Monroe. I said, I've done a lot of work with him. Really? He said, yeah. Who's on keyboards with you then? I said, the first guy was a guy called Colin Keyes. Oh, Colin. He said, yeah. Because my brother did a lot of him. I said, hang on. I said, he's the guy in the front door. And he opened the book. I went back. He said, yeah, that's him. I said, he picked up on him in Sheffield. I said, what happened? I said, our keyboard went ill. And he was drafting the guy up. And said, this guy come in and do this. He do his eyes closed. He's top man in London now. And this guy came in, and I was talking to him, and he said to me, I'm famous for this, he said. Dun, only my hand. I said, what's that? Well, it might be. Ding, ding. He's winding me up now, see, from the guests. I said, what are you on about? He said, I'll name that in three. Dun, dun, dun. On the telly thing, is it? I'll name that tune, is it? The competition thing, yeah. And then you see your face again. Yeah, I can see who you are now. And it's his bloody brother, man. What a small world. Mm. And then, not only that, Derek's was so chuffed. I got a great photo of Derek on the floor and Frank, because Frank has passed away now, and Derek's passed away. And I got a great photo of him, I guess, packing the kit away for me to bring you back. And Derek looks up like that to me.
I haven't actually seen that kit. I mean, I've seen it in the room, but I haven't seen it in the flesh. I'd love to actually. And my favourite fact about that kit that I think you've left off, or maybe I'm wrong, but didn't it also play the Only Fools and Horses theme?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's so. I think that was cool. But that's just a snare drum riff, isn't it? Amazing.
I think that's Ronnie Hazelhurst again. See, him and Ronnie Hazelhurst are big friends, and he's the cleanup piece to do all the. The links and all the things for these programs.
Yeah.
He did. My favorite is Last of the Summer Wine that Ronnie Hazelhurst did.
Yeah. Derek was telling me some insights. It's so we got on. We were swapping stories. I told him about the time that I was in Swansea Sound. I was doing adverts and one was for Buckley's Brewery. See? Now, you can remember, you had people coming in, officials on the brewery management, stuff like that, they wanted something. Sometimes they came in with an idea that they wanted to do exactly, like, you know, but 9 out of 10, they didn't really know what they wanted musically. And I said, I always remember one coming in, Alpine Frozen Foods, Swansea, right? And what's his name behind the Stan Hollabin, the guy behind the desk down here, big multi-track 14. He said, got a teaser for you this morning, boys. He said, what? Alpine Frozen Foods. Then I conjured up some images. And all the guys are there. And John Phillips down on keyboards. Genius. Hum it, he'll write it. If you hum it in B flat, he'll write it in B flat. Seriously. In the night, you sing it in F, you go, oh, you did it in B flat this morning. Why you changed key? Oh, have I?
Yeah, you I know people like that. It's
similar. Ah, what a genius. And who's writing? It's like a computer. It's all spaced. He writes it by hand. It's what's it, old school, old English writing? Oh, beautiful writing.
Like calligraphy.
Yeah, you can't miss it, you know. And he came out with a belter, didn't he? He said, we'll do that later. He said, I gotta go home. He's eccentric. He's like, oh, everything's under my nose. And he drinks like a fish, but he never lets you down with the playing. And he said, we'll go home, we'll back after dinner. He said, we've got another session. And we're getting paid now, say 10 o'clock in the morning till 12. I'm hired for £150. So by 11 o'clock, we banged it out, we finished. See? And Stan will say, listen, guys, I got another one in. He says, do you want to start the clock? Yeah, we'll stay. Like, it's another £150. Now it's 1 o'clock now. So you've earned double in the time of what you hired for.
Mm.
One. And we're going home now and coming back. He only walks in with a French horn. We didn't know he played all instruments, right? And he went, no, up in Swiss Valley, and he came out all this conjured up music because he's classically trained and he's jazzer, and he came out, right? But in the middle of the take, he's a guest, and he went, he stopped playing, he went, Pete James, man, oh, Pete some drums, look at that, he goes, and Stan goes, okay. John, he said, we're in the middle of a fucking take. He said, what are you doing? Oh. He's eccentric, see?
Yeah.
I've been with him all day, man. He's like, he had an Einstein brain, and he could play all instruments. And I mean all. I've heard him play the violin, like classically trained, piano classically trained, and he plays the jazz everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing guy. But, you know, pretty bad individual before he passed away, but otherwise, he'd be worse than me to go from one thing to that. Because I really think my life has been so, you know, like you mentioned, you know, like I went to a film to see Barrett Deems playing in the 50s when I was a kid, right? I didn't know what I was looking at. And I'm going to pictures in those days just to sort of mess about and meet girls. I didn't know what film was on. It's called High Society, right? I'll never forget it now, but I went in there. And we all messed about, and I could just walk to me. Fast. I thought, oh wow, like next thing somebody hit you with a tub. I said, shut up, and I'm watching the film, like, you know, all the boys are scrapping and messing about, you know. And they said, that, you know, quiet, you're going out down all that. And then I sort of said, now we take some sketch, boom, boom. No jazz begins. I thought, oh wow. And I had a school beside me, I always remember saying, I'm gonna be one of them.
Wow.
And then I'm this bloke, what are you going to be, Mush? I'm going to be what? You can't act and all that. Then when I get something taken away, no, you're a big film star. I said, no, the drummer, what drummer? He'd gone now. The scene had gone.
Barrett Deems and Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know it was Barrett Deems today.
Wow.
But I thought, yeah, I just thought, who's this? I just, what's his drums like? Beautiful sound. Like. And then come on into what? When did I go to? I was in Remo Center in West Hollywood, and it was lockout, you know, and the boys all setting up. And some guy there, thin as a rake, and you know, tie on like that. And I was with, what's his name, man? Critchley, he runs the show. And he was making me very welcome because I come from Wales, like, you know. He said, come on from Wales, yeah, wow, man. He gave me t-shirts and everything and all the bit. He made me welcome. And the other guy, and then, I saw this guy and he'd be making a big fuss of him, like, you know. And I didn't think anything of it, but I clocked it. And I thought he was something to do with the show and the place, because he's a really old man. But he was up on stage then, as a drum kid, and he started playing. And if you close your eyes and turn away, you think it's Buddy Rich. And I'm not exaggerating. Just Barrett Deems.
Wow.
Yeah. And I said to the guy, who the hell is that? That's you don't know, that's Barrett Deems. That's Barrett Deems. I said, I've heard of him and seen him in the movie. That's him. I said, yeah. Oh, I got to meet him. I said, I started, one of my reasons I started drumming. I started drumming before that. They said, but that was the icing on the cake. I said, when I saw him, I thought, you know. So I went up to him and, Kerry, when Kerry took me up to Kerry Critchley, he said, hi, he knew so well. Hi, what's happening, man? He said, this gentleman, he's come from the other side of the world. He said, and he'd like to say hello to you. He said, yeah, sure. And he said, where are you from? And you hear the accent. And the accent always gets on the youngest. They think they can't figure what it is. They know it's not England, but it's somewhere in Europe. Mm. Some say London. You know, to guys from Leeds, no, you wouldn't say London. Mm. Miles from there. But anyway, he's a gentleman. He's a lovely bloke. And I told him the story yesterday. And he said, oh, man, yeah. And he turned to the lot of bud time, I mean, a big crowd around us now. And he said, yeah, this is him, man. You've got to spread the word, man. You spread the word.
That's amazing.
He was lovely. And now, amazing. What have I got? His drum.
Yeah, you got one of his drums.
I've got his actual Black Beauty. That was made for him. All engraved. But isn't it funny, though, that I should look at that film, then meet him in the Remore Centre, not knowing who he was, and then end up with his drum.
I think that's life goes around. And as you said, sharing the knowledge, really. So, and I think that's a perfectly cheesy way to end this podcast off, really, with you sharing your knowledge and passing all this around. So, Pete, thanks so much for doing this today. I hope I know we can't have got every story down, but I hope we've given a good sample of kind of everything you've done. And what I think has been amazing about you is we've done it from a very like uniquely Welsh perspective. There's so many people like the British Invasion drummers and other musicians kind of have a bit of credibility now, but they're all from Liverpool or London, you know? So it's like, it's great to have, I want some Scottish and Irish drummers as well, you know? And so I think, you know, thanks for giving us this time and, you know, for being an amazing person and doing this. So it's really appreciated and it'll be out at some point in the future.
Well, it's okay. I hope it's not going to be too boring for the listeners, because remember, there's loads of us around. You're going to be a lot of stories, I guess, for the rest of your life.
Right. Thanks so much then, Pete. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, Martin.
So there we go. That was the end of the interview with Pete James, the chap that taught Jack drums from a very early age. And I think you've probably learned a lot of like life lessons as well from him, because he's a good guy that does, you know, plays, but wants to support his way of life. So from your point of view, Jack, you've known this guy a lot. He's good at telling stories. Like, did you learn anything new? Was there anything of interest there to you that popped out?
Yeah, I mean, I started having lessons with Pete when I was 10 until I went to music college, you know, and said he's my biggest inspiration for doing it, really. So that's very formative years of your life. So I think I only really realized in the last few years, yeah, that he's helped, you know, not just influence to be a drummer, but the kind of way to go around the way he does stuff is how I try and model myself and that I do as well. So I just wanted to get his story down, and hopefully people will enjoy what he's done. And as I said at the end of the actual interview, given like a very unique Welsh perspective on it, because I think that's isn't Liverpool or London is often overlooked, I think, from the British Invasion people. So I can't think of any specific stories there that I really, really loved, but they're all great. That's why I wanted to do this, you know.
The take home for me, and he made a great life following his dream. And I just think that is a glimpse into a world which perhaps doesn't exist, certainly to the same scale anymore. It's still there, but, you know, there's fewer opportunities. And I just think that's beautiful to see into that time, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s in Britain, that whole world, that cabaret, bar, whatever people call it, theatre kind of circuit. And the attitude to do it to be there to do a good job and to be somebody that people want to work with, which I think comes across with his work, is that he's a good guy.
Definitely.
And he kept getting the calls. And I think that, I don't know, I'm trying to say this to the listeners really, but I think that certainly reflects in you and your attitudes, you know, to working and playing.
Well, that's very kind. But yeah, I mean, I think everyone can take a piece of advice there, I think, from Pete.
Yeah, definitely. He's done it for real, you know. And also, just when you think about how formative the 60s and the British music scene was in the 60s, and how that's kind of shaped a lot of Western culture. So for him to sort of be in Abbey Road the same day as the Beatles, or to be in the Butlins and Status Quo having to fill in for them, and all these kind of like things, it's just, there's just a bunch of guys going around with guitars trying to make a life for themselves, and he's part of that, and I think that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. So I hope you've enjoyed that, and tune in next week for the next guest. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.